reasons why we have problems in higher education in Pennsylvania is because the state ranks 47th out of 50th of all states in the nation in what it contributes to all of higher education. You want a message to send back? Is make the state put more money into higher education. And in fact, let's talk about trying to figure out a way to make college free for all students in Pennsylvania.
It's Friday, March 2nd, 2018. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And today's show, holy crap, it's a big week, man. The nation got a window into what a post-Janus labor movement needs to look like. That's as West Virginia teachers look like they got a win on Tuesday after 4 days of statewide strikes. But teachers and education workers remain on strike today. Wildcat! As the state Senate balked at the modest salary increases negotiated between the governor and the union. And graduate students at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign certainly got the message. Members of the Graduate Employee Organization enter day five of their strike after nearly a year of negotiations broke down over tuition waivers, salary, and graduate student rights. The strike is now the longest in the university's history. The Intercept reports that the DCCC hired a consultant to do some internal polling, you know, because that's what the DCCC does. They hired consultants, right? The consultant report actively discourages the party and party candidates from supporting single-payer health care. The kicker? The polling firm didn't ask Democrats about single payer. How's that? Magic. Also in The Intercept this week, the Koch brothers are winning nonstop under Trump. Internal documents from the Koch brothers network show that they are celebrating the rollback of corporate regulations, the withdrawal from the Paris Accord on climate change, and the billionaire Levin tax reform package. Well, at least Paul Ryan is happy. According to that Intercept article, quote, days after the tax bill passed, Charles Koch and his wife donated $500,000 to Speaker Paul Ryan's joint fundraising leadership PAC. That's not too transactional now, is it?
You do this for me, and you're going to be happy in the end.
And Paul Ryan's, oh, I'm very, very, very happy, sir. Thank you, thank you, thank you. California passes automatic voter registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, getting them into the pipeline early, and that is going to be huge. That's all good, given this week's, you know, craziness around the country. California, that is going to have a huge impact on the next elections. We'll talk a little about that later. And this week, holy cow, freak warming in the Arctic. And you got today's arrival of the second bomb cyclone of 2018. And you have rare and deadly winter storms across Europe. If that's not enough, you know, Putin put on a dog and pony show announcing Russia's new invincible nuclear weapons. Wolverines! Red Dawn! We're going back, man. Going back to the 80s. And, you know, as he made those announcements, it was to thunderous applause in the Duma. Oh, almost forgot. Hey, Hope, white lies matter. Pennsylvania Republicans still trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to throw out new state congressional maps. Keep barking up that tree. Justice Alito denied him the last time, and we await his ruling this time around. Connor Lamb and Rick Saccone are now in a dead heat in the PA's 18th district special election. And that's as boatloads of right-wing money pours into the race, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. That election is March 13th, right around the corner, folks. Madeline Dean, now running in the PA 4th. And Dallin Leach drops out. Boo-hoo. Delco Republican Nick Marcinelli is accused of... they should be laughing about this, but this is just like, you know, holy crap. Is accused of drugging, raping, and threatening women with a gun in prior relationships. Micarelli decides, you know, threatening a reporter is a good response to the charges. a dozen or so of PA House and Senate members and their staffers are packing heat in the Capitol. That's comforting.
You better pass that law, mother...
Jesus. The Philly School Reform Commission votes to spend $20 million for cyber learning because kids love distance ed. Students from Northeast Pennsylvania School District relocated Wednesday due to an AR-15 blessing ceremony at the World Peace and Unification Sanctuary Church run by that cult leader, Hyungjin Moon. Some participants even donned crowns of bullets. Seriously, if you have not checked out the pictures of those things, oh my God. Posse budget hearings this week in the state Senate. And that demonstrates just how deep the anti-union sentiment is on the budget committee and in the Posse administration. Wagner threatens to shut down Posse universities. State Senator Vince Hughes calls Wagner's statements irresponsible, calling instead for a path towards free college tuition. You heard him, right, in the intro today. Posse Chancellor Karen Whitney calls collective bargaining out of whack. Good thing we got those students from the PA Student Power Network. They were active again this week. Students from PA Student Power Network were out in force on Tuesday, holding actions to defend DACA and to push for a Clean Dream Act. They held actions at 12 locations across the state, including actions at the offices of Senator Bob Casey, Representative Brendan Boyle in Montgomery County, Representative Mike Kelly in Erie, Representative Bob Brady's office in Philly, and of course, our pal, Representative Lou Barletta's office in Harrisburg. And they were demanding justice for 11 million undocumented immigrants. Kudos to you, folks. Kudos to you. In today's last call, I'm going totally political fanboy with Sarah Kenzior and Francesca Fiorentini this week. You've got to check out Fiorentini's, the segment from last week called Why the Rich Love Destroying Unions, and that's on her AJ Plus News Broke on Facebook and YouTube. And Sarah Kenzior was on the Rick Smith Show on Thursday, and she was on fire. Oh my God, you got to check out that segment. And Free Will is releasing Love Letter for the 90s this week. Once again, if you missed it last time, don't miss this one. And tomorrow, March 3rd, is Saucony Creek's 5th anniversary birthday party from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. at the brewery. It's an all-ages fest, and the Unicorn will be released. Bands include Hannah Violet from 12 to 3 p.m. and regional fave Frog Holler from 3 to 6 p.m. I want to remind everybody to tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I will be there once again giving the weekly resistance report. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you miss a show, just go to freespeech.org. All the shows are archived right there on the site. Want to give a special shout-out and thanks to Scars for Justice. Thank you, Lou, from Scars for Justice. You remember Lou Ryan was writing for Raging Chicken for a while, and she's out in Pittsburgh now. She basically has got an Etsy site called Scars for Justice where you go and she makes scarves, and you buy the scarves. You get to choose who you're going to donate stuff to, we've got a nice little donation this week. So thanks again, Lou. And if you like what you hear, you too can become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little $5 a month. Keep the media in the movement and the movement in the media, folks. Come on. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member yet, no problem. You can make a one-time donation by going to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, click on donate, and you'll be good to go. And, you know, it's funny this week, you know, I want to encourage everybody. Look, I heard from several people this week. It was just kind of like a flood of these things, both on email and in person, about how many people are listening to the show. I got some kind of calls out of the blue about listening to the podcast and so on. So that was awesome to hear. Now I want you to take that next step and become a member of Raging Chicken Press. Again, patreon.com/rcpress. $5 a month, folks, really. Become a member and support Pull No Punches Progressive Media. So, Sean, man, a lot in the headlines today for our little podcast here.
Yeah, well, first off, I want to start by making an announcement.
He's got an announcement. Everybody, wait.
This is going to be my last week doing this because I got hired for a press director, a communications director position.
Man, I was going to wait to the end of the show, Sean, to let everybody know, but You know, look, I lived in D.C. for a long time, and I could say nothing but good things about it. So, congratulations, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, there's a pretty big communications director spot opened up this past week. You know, it's down to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Someone might need some help doing social media and damage control. So,
well, yeah, you know, look, Hope Hicks didn't have any experience to do that yet either. So, Sean, I think that you're going to be able to fill that position with no problem. I mean, all you need to do is that you got to remember it's not a government, it's a mob, right? And then you're all set. And all you got to do is every day you go, Godfather. Just call him Godfather, and he'll be happy. He'll get a kick out of that. That's my tip for the day.
It's been good, but I guess we got to get a podcast to get going.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's get doing it. All right, so this week, huge. Obviously, we talked about this on last week's podcast. And then on last Saturday, I was down in Philadelphia for the kind of Working People's Day of Action ahead of the Janus versus AFSCME court case that was being heard before the Supreme Court this past Monday. It was a huge turnout in Philly, man. I'll tell you, we had, representatives from unions across the state. We had labor leaders from across the country. SEIUs, every union you could imagine was there. And it was good for me to be on the ground there, just basically hearing what the message were coming out, not just for the labor leaders, but also kind of hear the talk of the crowd among members who were basically not giving up this fight. Because, the court case that was heard on Monday, Janus versus AFSCME, everyone is basically expecting that this is going to go against public sector unions. We're going to be in a new world, right? We're going to be in a new world after this ruling comes down. We're expecting it in the spring, maybe as late as June. It's been interesting seeing some of the discussions and some of the reporting that's been coming out this week about that.
Yeah. All because of a what's this guy, a college professor or a school teacher?
You school teacher.
Yeah. You know who else was a school teacher?
Tom Corbett.
And Matt Briette.
Matt Briette.
Yes. Supposedly he was a school teacher, and Matt Briette is someone, I believe he was a school teacher. He touts that he was. Someone from the Commonwealth Foundation leads that. Also leads another group, the Commonwealth Partners of Entrepreneurs or something like that, basically to get right-wing candidates elected to office. And one of the organizations, a bunch of the organizations that he's involved with, have brought up cases of fair share fees against, in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, this definitely looks like this. Well, this is obviously a tactic used by the right wing across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you were talking about this, before we went today, this report that came out from EPI, right? Just saying, if you had any question about exactly what, where this stuff was coming from, it's pretty clear at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says.
Sorry. Just let me sink.
No problem.
No, my phone's just going off right now, and I'm just trying to turning it off.
No, but anyway, so we see the kind of money that goes. I think there's been some really good articles that have come out. There was one in These Times last week that's looking at, it's called The Two Faces of Janus. A fantastic article. I might have mentioned it last week's show too as well. I've been sending it out to people that just basically documents the kind of money that is behind this Janus court case, right? Because very often the way that this gets framed in the kind of popular media for most of the time, although there's been some good reporting out there, is here's this guy, Mark Janus, and he just didn't want to pay union fees. He thought it was an attack on his freedom of speech, and so therefore he brought this legal case. When really what we find out that there's a huge apparatus, a huge well-funded effort to ensure the destruction of public sector unions. At least that's what they're going after. So, you know, I mean, there's a one on the one case, there's a specifics of this case, and we can get into that at some point. But there's also the kind of more important thing is like, you know, look, what motivates this? The only reason why this is the Supreme Court is because you've got billionaire backed efforts to destroy public sector unions, period. Right.
Now, wasn't this case originally started by Bruce Rauner from Illinois?
Yeah, but he couldn't bring a case forward. He didn't have standing.
He wanted to get rid of.
Right. He didn't have standing in the case, right? He wanted to bring it forth, but he said that no, the court was basically saying, look, you don't have standing in this case. You're not being directly affected by this, right? So they had to kind of dig somebody else up that would be willing to, be the front boy for it. And the poster boy endured, you know, is Mark Janis, right? And he's been a good one, too, because he's kind of like a little bit soft-spoken. He's been doing all the videos, right? You know, you got these high-production videos that are going out where he's just talking about what a victim he's been in this whole process and how the unions, big bad unions, are kind of interfering with his freedom of speech, all this kind of garbage, which is at the center of the court case. But, you know, look, ultimately it doesn't matter, right? I mean, ultimately the merits of the case are not what's going to matter here because we've got a politically loaded Supreme Court. Right. And then once Donald Trump was elected, right, that was, you know, all gloves were off and we knew that going in. Right. That was one of the key things that was at issue in the last election was filling that ninth Supreme Court seat. And here we are. You know, you got Neil Gorsuch, which is basically going to be the guy who's going to, you know, send unions back to, you know, white right to work nation.
Yeah, and we could thank the Democrats for not forcing the Republicans' hand on, you know, calling a vote for a Supreme Court justice, and, you know, here we are.
Yeah, and this is like, you know, this is the whole idea about playing nice, right? The whole idea, well, we don't want to kind of force things too much. We know, look, we talked about this on the podcast, right? We talked on the podcast, like, in 2016, like, after the election, right? Obama basically could have gone forward and could have made a recess appointment of Supreme Court justice to fill that seat. Right. Because Mitch McConnell had basically said, you know, refused to have any hearings on Obama's appointee. Right. There was no way that they were going to let that go. Mitch McConnell was saying that publicly. And when we want to recess, Obama could have gone ahead and made that recess appointment. And yes, it would have been challenged by the Republicans when they came back. But that would have meant that, you know, Merrick Garland would have been sitting on the Supreme Court. During that case, right, they would have had to fight and bring lawsuits, which would probably taken a year or two in order to kind of move forward on that case. And then we would have been, had a little breathing room here. But nope, don't want to do that because we respect the institutions or whatever. Then when Trump gets in there and he got his candidate goes forward, the Democrats get worried that they're going to be seen unreasonable. And so now we get Neil Gorsuch, right? And now we're going to see the Janis case go through with flying colors in favor of right to work nation. So,
yeah. And one thing is to say, if the Democrats do get, some control of the Senate with this upcoming election, looks like they possibly could with the way the wave that's coming. Do you think they would do the same thing if a Supreme Court justice passed away or stepped down?
Let's play out the scenario. Are we talking about before or after the 2018 election? And before
after the 2018 election, they have control of the Senate.
So if they have control of the Senate, do you think that they're going to kind of put a stop on the Supreme Court justice? Is that your question?
Yeah.
I think that's going to depend on the makeup of who gets elected, right? I think I honestly think that if the status quo is kind of remains in place, right, in terms of like the people that are elected, no, they're not going to do it. They're not going to have the backbone once again. But if there is enough of a wave of really progressive candidates. There's going to be, I think, pushes with inside even the establishment Democratic Party, right, to realize that, okay, the winds are blowing against them and they should just ride the wave. Because, look, ultimately what that group is about keeping their own power, right, and staying into the positions of power and leadership in the Democratic Party. So if they see the writing on the wall for the kind of like the centrist crap that they've been schlocking now for decades, I think people like Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and I mean, I know that Nancy Pelosi is not relevant in terms of the Senate, in terms of the hearings, but I think like Schumer and his crew would push back a little bit more, right? I think it would make them extraordinarily uncomfortable, but I think they would push back just to keep their power. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad in the end that what's going to happen and the results of what happens with Janice, we're not dependent on kind of like, you know, some kind of centrist leaning Democratic Party. I think we have the example of what has to happen in West Virginia right now. For those folks, if you've, you know, been under a rock for a while, right, West Virginia teachers went out on strike. What was initially billed as a 2-day strike. So as we went into our podcast last week, that was the second day of the West Virginia teacher strike. And we talked about it on the podcast last week. All 55 counties in West Virginia had to shut down their schools because teachers statewide were on strike. And that happened despite the fact that there were warnings that came out that basically said, look, this is not legal, right? It's not legal for teachers to go out on strike like this, for the public school teachers go out on strike in the state of Virginia. They went anyways, right? And they faced the threats and intimidation. And then what started as a 2-day strike, then nope, they carried over into the Monday and Tuesday of the following week. And then there was an agreement that was reached between union leaders and the state's governor, Governor Justice, ironic name, I have to say. And that was basically teachers were going to get a 5% salary increase. That was one of the key things, right? West Virginia ranks 48th out of 50th in the country, right, in terms of support for public education and public teacher salaries. That was one of the sticking points. There were some other issues, too, as well, that had to do with benefits, that had to do with control, that had to do with state funding, a whole bunch of other stuff. But that was the deal that was reached. And Wednesday was going to be a, quote-unquote, cooling off day, which the strike lines were going to come down, and then they were going to wait, and everybody was going to go back to work on Thursday. However, the teachers were like, cool off my ass, right? And they stayed in the streets. They kept up the picket lines. They kept up the pressure in the state capitol in Charleston. And good thing, right? Good thing that these teachers are showing us to learn the lesson of not like, hey, look, they came to an agreement. Yay, we won, and go back home. Until you've got the goods in your hand, you stay in the streets, right? And that's what they did, because sure enough, the House, right? So basically, they had to have a bill that would approve this funding increase that would cover the raise of the teacher salary, the increase in teacher salary. The House passed it. It got to the state Senate, and the state senators in West Virginia were like, you know, for the longest time, we've been talking about budget problems and all this kind of stuff. The governor thinks sub we're going to come up with this money. Right. We're going to put this under advisement. Right. So they sent it off to a committee to go study it. Right. And the teachers are like, you don't pass it, we don't go back to work. And now they're still in the streets. I mean, it's been an unprecedented, at least in the 21st century. Right. At least in kind of like, you know, well-established labor unions, we have not seen this kind of labor militancy in a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, this is almost getting to the levels, but in a different way, of what happened in Wisconsin a few years ago. I mean, the way that this is working, but also like reading what teachers are doing behind the scenes, not just like on the picket lines. You know, you look through some of the things on Twitter, what they're doing. I mean, they're making sure that their students who need to be fed, low-income students who need to be fed because of, you know, school programs that provide those meals for them, they are getting the food that they need.
Yes.
And, you know, doing that type of community outreach, that type of community work, only makes your appeal stronger within the community. When you have teachers delivering food to those doors, or teachers making sure those kids are getting their food, you know, it makes that sense of, you know, unionism more stronger.
Absolutely. No, and this is the model going forward. Is like, you know, I think I've said this on this show. I've talking to anybody who will listen about it. Is like going forward, there is no other model of unionism, right? The we're done, right, with the kind of business unionism, with the behind-the-scenes players and all that kind of stuff. And look, I'm no fool. I know that you need people that can negotiate, that can work with politicians, that can kind of get behind the scenes and kind of make cases and things like this. But in a post-Janus world, the only way, in a right-to-work world, and the only way that those people who are doing those negotiations have any power whatsoever is that if you have a mobilized member that is networked into the community, that is invested in building social movements for justice, social movements to kind of change the way that this country is going. So, again, we saw this, for example, in Philadelphia. We saw the Caucus of Working Educators. They have been kind of at this for a while now, right, building those connections with parents, with students, right? I'm making sure that they're kind of not just kind of fighting for their own issues, but actually fighting alongside members of the community who are trying to get kind of access to fair housing, that are trying to make sure that people are fed, right? This is the direction going forward. And, you know, there's a really good piece in the Jacobin this past week about lessons for a post-Janus world. It's an article called It Started in Wisconsin by Ben Mansky and Sarah Mansky. I'll put it in the show notes. Encourage everyone to check it out because it's a kind of sober, careful thinking through saying of like, okay, here's what we need to learn from what happened in Wisconsin that started this whole kind of what right to work craziness that we're in right now. And then where we have to go from here. And the conclusion in that article, like every other thing we see right now, is like, look, labor militancy has to go back. If you're not willing to step up and defend what you're doing, you're not willing to step up and stand behind the union, it's like not only are you're going to lose your union, right, but your dignity at work is going to go away. The very profession that you're part of, your very daily work is going to become that much more dangerous, that much more brutal, that much more like under the control of the whims of management. And that's going to take us back a long, long ways. So we got to get up to speed fast and kind of move forward. So those West Virginia teachers, man, it's been incredible.
Yeah.
So I was also kind of thrilled to see this out in Illinois, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. They're a graduate student union there. It's called a Graduate Employees Organization. It's actually one of my former students, Allie, actually kind of she did her graduate studies out there, and she was there for I think her I want to say her second year there, and she was out on strike with the GEO at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. But what's happening here right now, once again, battles over things like tuition waivers and cost of living, right? Graduate students are paid just over $16,000 a year there, which is about, I think, $3,000, if I remember my numbers correctly, about $3,000 below the cost of living in Urbana-Champaign as published on the university's own website, right? So the university is basically paying their employees, right, graduate student employees who are teaching these classes, paying them below the cost of living or below the poverty line in Urbana-Champaign. So they're out on strike, and now that it's officially gone to day five today, and that makes it the longest strike in the history of the university. So our thoughts and solidarity are with you all out there in Illinois. This is also a very important case because we know Illinois is front and center at the right to work challenges. So you see that, you know, the governor has long been trying to kind of gut labor unions in the state. He's been a strong backer. He was actually at the arguments, the Janus arguments, if I remember correctly. And he's been wants to make this a right to work nation. And so now you've got these graduate students in that environment stepping out and saying, nope, we're not going to do this. We're not going to kind of just roll over. We're going to fight back and we're going to dig in. So, whoop, there you go. Gotta love that, Sean. But there's that. So we talked about this a little bit beforehand. To shift gears a little bit, you got the union fights in the streets. And then kind of like just one more reason why we need to make sure that all the pressure that we don't trust for one second that the Democratic Party is going to do what it needs to do on its own. That the only way it's going to do the right thing is that, you know, we've got to put pressure on them. So, I mean, did you get a chance to take a look at that article from at all from The Intercept, Sean?
I have not.
Well, it was pretty. It was pretty crazy, right? So it's just basically
la 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 la
la la la la la la.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me. Well, yeah, basically that was it, right? The Democrats, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, they hired they hired a couple consultants, right? They hired Greenberg, Quinlan, Rosner Research, and GBA Strategies to help them, you know, think through healthcare messaging, right? And so the firm comes back with its report, right? And of course, The Intercept has got it and, you know, published it, right? And
that's what I love about The Intercept.
Yeah. They published the full documents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they come back and the report is basically comes out very strongly against the Democratic Party or Democratic Party candidates, right? Or sitting Democratic Party representatives or lawmakers, discourages them from getting behind from advocating for single payer, right? So, and on the one hand, you say, okay, so this polling firm went out and asked a bunch of people what they thought about single payer, and they were surprised to find out that most Democrats out there were not at all behind single payer, right? Well, not exactly. Right. The question that they asked, right? Here's the question that they ask. Are you ready? The question they ask is, if you could change one thing about your health care or health insurance, what would it be? That was the question. Right. And even, okay, now, despite the fact that that was the question, right, still 12% of voters still came back and said, single payer, right? Even though that is not what the question was asking, 12% of people even come back and inserted that into it. That's what I want changed, right? So they get the results on this, and they've got a whole bunch of different things, and 44% of the people come back and they say, oh, I would make it cheaper or more affordable, lower premiums and deductibles. Some people, 12%, said no, nothing. I wouldn't do anything. I got no complaints. Another 12% said make it single payer. Right. So there you go. 5% said make it easier to understand, less complicated. 4% said have more choices or plans. 4% said get government out of healthcare. Right. 4% of Democrats actually said get government out of healthcare. That's interesting. Right. And 1% said get rid of individual mandate. 2% said make it make me only pay for what I need. Right. So you've got even like in the Democratic Party, the hyper corporate ends of things. Right. The Tea Party.
It also shows you like if you have 4% Democrats saying that get government out of health care, it really shows you how bad Democrats are in the messaging game, because that means they're eating up shit that the Republicans are feeding out there because the Democrats are not putting out a counter message.
Right. Exactly.
And they're just regurgitating the stuff they're hearing on TV all the time, because the Democrats are failing to come up with a counter message, and the shit they're hearing on TV is the shit coming from the Republicans.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, that right there is a messaging thing, right? I did a quick Google search right now, right? Single payer healthcare support. 52% of Americans support single healthcare. Majority of Americans support single payer. Modestly strong but malleable support for single payer. Sorry, Republicans, but most people support single payer healthcare. These are all articles within the past 6 months to like 8 to 6 months.
Yeah. And if you actually look at some of those polls, right, some of those polls that come out, right, and that's of all Americans, right, that you just
like
cited.
52%, 48%, plurality support single payer healthcare, or
right,
majority support single payer healthcare.
And if you break that down by party, though, look at the number of Democrats, right, it's so much higher. So that's why it's important. Those numbers are winning, right, across the board among Democrats and Republicans.
Like 12% of people said, yeah, single payer healthcare compared to the rest.
Exactly. Right. I mean, it's incredible. Now, what's remarkable about that, too, as well, is that, like, look, this poll basically represents like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right.
So you see, like if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, does it make a sound?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, if you think about it, right, if I ask people what's one thing you would change about your healthcare, right, and what I've just done with that question, I've got people to think about their own personal healthcare and what their relationship is with that. And so they're going to think about their visits to the doctor. They're going to think about what is, and of course, healthcare is too expensive, right? Especially under the kind of Affordable Care Act. Like people have, yes, the mandate goes in, people get have healthcare now, but a lot of people are still struggling just to meet those payments, right? So basically what this polling firm did is they took the establishment Democrats' message, turned it into a question. They got the answer back exactly what you would expect to begin with. And they said, see, this is what the people want. It's so disgusting. Right. And if you read the report that's published in The Intercept, right. So like a good chunk of that report is actually saying, going step by step, point by point about why we should advocate, either not advocate for single payer or advocate against single payer. Right. So this is why, folks, you know, do not trust these people. Right.
Yeah. Fuck DCCC.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and in the meantime, you know, this past weekend, I believe, you know, DSA, right, is out there in the streets going door to door, right, talking to people and advocating for single payer health care down in Philadelphia and different places around the country. Right.
Did you see what speaking about like DSA and socialism, did you see what Jeremy Corbyn did this week over in England?
No, I don't know. I didn't.
Him and a bunch of other labor activists are starting a campaign to restore the clause 4 of the labor constitution, which basically like socialize the industries. It was the clause that whatchamacallit, Tony Blair got rid of.
Oh.
Right back in like the '90s. And so they want to bring this back to clause 4. And basically what Corbyn says, new labor is dead. It's time to bring back bold socialist policies. And it says labor for clause 4, group as it demands the reversal of Tony Blair symbolic reform. And basically they're attacking privatization, going after pretty much the same shit Democrats have been doing here in the United States for the past 30 years. You know?
Yeah. There you go, man.
There's my, Jez is my inspiration.
It's about to arrive.
There you go. Oh my God, what did I just do?
Raymore
sorry.
Everything's on sale.
Everything's on sale.
But
I hate the autoplay commercials on websites. Sorry. No, exactly. And this is phenomenal. This is phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, like, single payer healthcare might be like one of the most popular fucking demands within the Democratic Party. And your question is, what would you change about your healthcare?
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right. Well, imagine if the option is like, would you like if they look, it'd be one thing if they went out and they asked the question, right. Would you support single payer healthcare or a Medicare for all approach to health insurance? Right. And then if that only 12% came back and said, yes. Right. Then you'd have a legitimate, legitimate result that you'd come back to the party with, right? You find out actually, okay, yeah, there's a lot of excitement about it, but it's not there. But that's not what that was.
Go
ahead, sorry.
You look at like the question, the response that came in first: make it cheaper, more affordable, lower premiums, deductibles, and drug prices. The second response was make it single payer, universal, socialized.
Exactly. Right, and we should say that a single payer system would do exactly those things. Right, would resolve all those things in the majority response.
One fell swoop.
Right. But what it requires, like here's the thing, right? What it requires is it requires to fight back, to end the kind of give backs to the rich, right? To basically take a stand against this kind of like, you know, like pseudo meritocratic system, right? That gives everything to the top 1%, top 0.1%. It would take to claw back the money that has been kind of like redistributed upward to those people, right? And then say, we all deserve it too as well. Is that workers are the ones who make the money for these people. And then the government has been put in the service of billionaires to take money out of the pockets of everyday people that are doing the work and put it in the hands of a bunch of loafers who are sitting there kind of, you know, sitting on top of the world on their piles of cash. That's what we require the party to do. And they don't want to do that in terms of the leadership.
And I wonder, like, which candidates are actually, like, listening to this bullshit, too. Like, is it the people like Christine Hartman, who we'll talk about this in the next segment, but who was the DCCC pick to run in Lancaster, who's now running in Harrisburg? you know, because of the maps getting changed? Like, is she going to look at this like at face value? Like, oh, okay, I won't talk about this because these are where my marching orders are coming from.
Well, I don't even think it's like that, Sean. I don't even think it's like about marching orders. I think, literally, I mean, the idea is that what we have in terms of Democratic Party leadership right now, right? You know, again, I know I'm overgeneralizing here, but a lot of the Democratic Party leadership, they come from a very specific professional class, right? I mean, this is the kind of, you know, like this is listen liberal, right? Why am I spacing a guy's name?
What's Thomas Frank.
Name? Thomas Frank, right? It's the argument that Thomas Frank has made, right? It's the argument that, you know, we've seen a different kind of like identity of the Democratic Party that shifted away from working people and has gone to this kind of professional class. And frankly, those people talk to each other, right? And so it doesn't seem strange. These arguments do not seem strange to them, right? Because they're not experiencing what most of us in this country are experiencing. Right. And so that's what's happened. So Christine Hartman is just kind of like it's confirmation bias. Right. So she's talking about this stuff and you have the Democratic Party leadership that, and they kind of see eye to eye on stuff. Right. It's not even necessarily marching orders. But, you know, this is what we learned also from, you know, Crystal Ball when she came to the Keystone Progress Summit. And she's talking about how one of the first things that, you know, the DCCC and the Democratic Party and states do is they come up to you. You want to run for Congress? You want to run for office?
OK, and how much money can you raise?
Yeah. Give me your phone and show me how many contacts you hear that can raise. What was the number she gave? Do you remember?
I did not.
Like some of millions of dollars. Right. Show me how you're going to raise that kind of money. And if you cannot show them that, you're not going to get their support. Right. And so, again, it basically says you have to be already wealthy and connected to networks of wealthy people before we will even allow show you support from our party. And that's what we're getting the pushback right now from. We're getting pushback from people who are showing people power against money power. And that's why these Democratic Party leaders are getting nervous. But one thing I want to correct from what we said earlier, Mark, this just kind of popped in my head as we were talking. Mark Janis was a child support specialist, not a teacher per se. Right. So we should kind of say this. Want to kind of correct that as we're kind of moving forward for the Janis case. So anyway, sorry. Sidebar for that.
I just saw a video on my Twitter feed of the Capitol, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. It is packed
today.
Yes.
Yep. I saw this morning. I saw some pictures this morning that are coming out where people were basically kind of already beginning to arrive early this morning. I was like, holy cow. Holy cow.
Yeah.
So I'll just say something quick about this. I mean, I don't know what more you need to say, what more evidence you need. But, you know, Charles Koch and his brother David Koch and their whole network of, you know, billionaire and wealthy donors and all that kind of stuff are absolutely celebrating with Trump. I think, you know, they're basically, if you look at a memo, again, once again, the Internet Intercept posted this. This is this memo that was circulated in their networks. And it's just basically just gloating, like almost kind of like unbelievable gloating about how much that they've been getting under Trump. Some of the tone, like, for example, this is kind of a quote from it. It says, quote, "This year, thanks in part to research and outreach efforts across institutions, we have seen progress in many regulatory priorities this network has championed for years." Right. And it goes through, it highlights out how they've got wins on environmental issues, how they've got wins on, you know, gutting the EPA, how they've gotten wins on getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement, how they've gotten wins against kind of, you know, givebacks to the billionaire class. And these are the Koch brothers who basically would not get behind Donald Trump, right, officially, because they're like, this guy, he's too much out here. And they're almost like, in the words in this document, they're surprised. It comes across as like the surprise. We can't believe how we got these things. These are the things that we wanted forever. We didn't think they were going to be possible. And sure enough, we got basically everything. We're running the table on this. So, you know, this is kind of what we're looking forward. So the big donors are winning hard right now. And because the craziness that's happening with the Trump, you know, I got to mention this before, but because of the craziness that is happening in the Trump administration, not enough attention is being paid right now to how the basic institutions of governance that have really kind of taken generations to build up to kind of provide, you know, workplace safety, to provide kind of, you know, clean air, clean water, all, you know, some things that we just take for granted, how those very institutions are just being gutted under the Trump administration. So So that's why I guess the one thing I'm glad about how you're going to be – you'll be working in the White House now, Sean, replacing yeah. Hope Hicks. Maybe you can turn that around a little bit. Oh, man. Well, let me run through a couple things here just real quick before we take a break. Just wanted to say that, you know, California, they just passed laws that basically for automatic voter registration, starting with 16 and 17-year-olds, they're going to be kind of put into the pipeline so that when the moment that they turn 18, they're going to be automatically registered to vote. That's a huge move forward. That means it's going to increase the amount of voter turnout to those elections. And this goes back to something Sean and I were talking about before the show today. Sam Cedar over at the Majority Report was saying that, you know, some of this was pointing out some of the schemes or some of the things that people should be doing maybe in those states is even passing mandatory voting is kind of what you see in systems like Australia and things like this, because it would basically be a way of showing the lack of representations of huge majorities of the country. So that's kind of, you know, this is a step in that direction. So the other thing that we got to point out, this past week in the Arctic, there's been a few days that have come above freezing in the Arctic in the middle of winter. Scientists are kind of really, really troubled by this. They're seeing melting of the Arctic Ocean in the middle of winter. And that is happening at the same time, right as we speak right now. There is a huge, powerful storm coming up. It's going to be a big nor'easter. It's going to be dumping tons of snow and winds and rain, tons of coastal flooding. There's going to be two high tides during this major wallop. And this morning, reports started coming out that they expect this to become like one of these bomb cyclones, like we saw earlier in January, that came up the East Coast, and this will be the second of the year in the winter, which is really, really problematic. That's happening at the same time is that you've got over in Europe. You've got these, Europe is being bombarded with these bizarre rare blizzards and heavy snowfalls. There's been at least 55 people as of this morning that have been killed because of this. 21 people killed in Poland alone. The World Health Organization has come out and basically said, yep, the homeless and the migrants are going to be hit especially hard. And this is an important message because, you know, this is, again, you look at what everyone's saying, who studies these issues, who's activists around climate change, is that the effects of climate change are going to be disproportionately felt by those people who are already disenfranchised from the current system. They're already on the receiving end of it. Right. So as the media follows what's being dubbed, you know, the beast of the east, the Siberian bear, the snow cannon. That's what they're terming these storms over in Europe. We start looking at that global picture. And right now we're seeing unprecedented severe weather, again, right in lines of climate change at the very moment that the EPA is being gutted, that the United States has pulled out of the Paris agreements. You know, we're in trouble if we don't kind of push back super hard. And then just to add, you know what, insult to injury, I guess, Vladimir Putin is like ahead of the elections over there in Russia, gives this big presser and then basically shows some kind of graphics that look like they were done in like in the 80s or whatever, but whatever. And basically says Russia has got a whole bunch of new invincible nuclear weapons that it's prepared to deploy. And then the Duma stands up and claps behind Putin ahead of time, throwing yet another kind of like log on the fire of kind of global destruction that we see. So what a week, man. What a week. Crazy. Oh, Sean, what do you think? We should take a break?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too, as well. I got to say, I'm just going to give kudos to Sean right now because Sean was sick for a good chunk of the week this week. And, you know, he's pulled it together this morning, had himself some sausage. He's back in the chair. So one last podcast before he heads to the White House to fulfill Hope Hicks on part of seat. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I want to remind everybody, if you like what you hear here, you want to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement, you want to support Pull No Punches Progressive Media, become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/RC Press. We'll be back right after this and we'll get into some PA fun.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day 9,300 workers walked out at Greyhound Bus Lines. minutes. The 1980s devastated Greyhound workers. First, the industry had been rocked by President Carter's deregulation of the transportation industry. Then, a bitter 1983 strike ended in defeat for the workers. Concessionary contracts, deep wage cuts, and a two-tier wage system were firmly established by the time contract negotiations started in early 1990. The Amalgamated Transit Union negotiated terms closer to what was lost over the past decade. But the new owners at Greyhound would have none of it. They claimed $300 million in debt. The ATU insisted the company had been turning a handsome profit. Pickets went up at depots and garages around the country, while hundreds of scab drivers were hired. With a week's worth of training, they were soon operating 10-ton buses unsafely. Riders complained of replacement drivers falling asleep at the wheel. The strike soon turned violent and deadly. There were reports of sniper fire and bomb threats. Many charged that these were fake stories meant to spike public support for the strike. Early on, 59-year-old Robert Waterhouse was run down by a scab driver while on the picket line in Redding, California. Waterhouse had 30 years as a driver with the company and had planned his retirement for that summer when he was killed. ATU reported many more picket line injuries. Within a month, the company was operating with 2,400 replacement drivers. The company filed for bankruptcy in June. After 3 years, they would finally agree to $22 million in back pay, reinstate hundreds of drivers, and raise wages. But the number of drivers was cut in half. It would take the ATU years to rebuild its strength.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. You know, Sean, on the break just now, went upstairs to grab some water, go to the bathroom, things like that. And it's like a driving crazy, like, blizzard outside my door right now. This morning was just, like, raining a little bit, and we were just talking about this as we kind of went to break. And now it's, like craziness happening out there. Oh, man.
Nice.
Yeah, it was just, like, what? It was just, like, 80 degrees last week or a week and a half ago, too?
Yeah. It only snowed a little bit out here.
Well, here we go. All right, well, let's get to it, man. So, PA Republicans can't let it go, I guess, huh?
can't let what go?
Can't let the new maps go. They're going back to Alito. Come on, Sammy. Please, Sammy. Please. Please.
So, I think that here's a couple things.
Yeah.
Their argument is pretty much the same argument they made the last time, and Alito denied it. And the federal court they brought this to didn't issue their stay. Instead, they want to have a hearing on it, which both goes to show you that probably both courts are not going to issue a stay on this.
Yeah, that's what it looks
and
like.
What I believe that this sets up for is a serious talks of impeaching the Supreme Court, the PA Supremes.
So you think they're really going to do that? That they're not just going to bluster with it?
I think that it's going to heat up mm-hmm. a lot.
Interesting.
The reason is because there's a bunch of people running for office. They're going to use it as a political case. And I think that both courts are going to deny a stay, the Supreme Court and the federal court. And then they're going to the Republicans, the House Republic or the Pennsylvania Republicans are going to try to go forward, or they're going to make a lot more of a bluster with the impeaching the courts. They're going to try to do this because they're not getting their way.
So not necessarily – so you don't think necessarily they're going to get to the point of kind of holding impeachment hearings, or do you think they're actually kind of – they'll go that far?
I do, yes.
Wow. Well, that's encouraging. That's encouraging to know that the
– like if you look at it like the – just the stuff that's going out there, Val DiGiorgio, the new head of the Republican Party, is talking about impeachment. You have Pat Toomey endorsing it. You have others who are open to it. I think that this is an issue that I think that they're trying to go forward with to intimidate the courts.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I think that, you know, when Toomey gave that presser, when he came out, basically, you know, impeachment, all this other kind of garbage that came out, he had to, and we talked a little bit about this, but, you know, I'm sure that that's why he was here. I mean, he was here to kind of strategize, put together some sort of political strategy to deal with this because they recognize the writing's on the wall. I mean, not only are they talking about you know, losing seats and kind of losing their gerrymander. But you know, they might just, you know, kind of lose the House, lose the Senate.
I mean, if you look at it, if the Republicans pick up, if Democrats pick up six seats on top of what they have here, so it's a 9-9 race.
Yep.
That's 25% of the seats they need to flip the House right there in Pennsylvania.
That's pretty significant. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty nuts, man. So I mean, let's get into some of the, so, I mean, well, okay. So we don't know when that's going to happen yet now. So I guess that what we're looking forward down the pike is Alito's got a rule, right? He's basically got to come out and deny that yet. That hasn't happened yet. And at that point, we're just going to be, you know, looking for that next step, I guess. Right. Because I mean, the deadlines for filing and everything are coming up.
Yeah. And I don't think that the Supreme Court's going to want to touch this for two reasons. One, it's separation between judicial powers. The state, you know, Supreme Court doesn't really like overturning state courts. You know, it's Marbury versus Madison. It's one of the oldest, you know, legal precedents we have in this country. And then two, the Supreme Court is ruling on two important gerrymandering cases already, and they don't want to take up a third one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? It looks like they're going to overturn partisan gerrymandering anyway, by the way you look at what's going on. I think they're going to issue a stay on this. I think they're not going to issue a stay on this. I think they're just going to let it be fall in place.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that's what's, well, so.
And the Republicans' argument pretty much like falls into like one line of one paragraph of the state constitution, not the bigger picture. So they're pretty much like parsing out a phrase out of like a whole entire chapter. Says this.
Well, this is the strategy, right? It's the political strategy. Is like, you know, and this is again when it's a well proven one. We see this on the way that Fox News works, the way that the PA, or not just the Pennsylvania GOP, but the national GOP has operated. You go, you pull out this one little thing, you rally your base around that, you kind of like wave your arms a lot, you go on Fox News, you talk about how this is power grabbed. You know, the only thing that they don't have going for them right now is the fact that, you know, you don't have like a black guy who's a governor or a black guy who's a president in order to kind of hit up against, right? So they lose that kind of like that, the racial fear stuff that they've been using for years. And now that they're going to, you know, they're going to do the same thing. They say, look, this is injustice, when really there's no other context.
So
we'll see. Well, let's take a look at some of the races here, because I mean, there's some cool stuff. I mean, interesting things happening across the state right now, especially with these new districts. But you've got Connor Lamb and Rick Saccone like in a dead heat in a special election set for March 13th. And that's pretty big.
Yeah. I guess so. Well, I haven't been following this race at all.
Oh, you have? I mean, yeah, you're the one who first put it on my radar, right? Because I look what's going on here. But so I'll just say this about it then. So, I mean, it's kind of really interesting. And look, this is not like a progressive like against Rick Saccone. I mean, Connor Lamb is fairly kind of centrist and things like this in his views.
And he pissed off unions a couple of weeks ago by not supporting a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Exactly. Right. So let's make sure that when we're saying that Connor Lamb might win this. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's a win for progressive in this particular instance. However, it's been notable because a couple things have happened. Number one, the Center for Responsive Politics has basically put out a report basically showing that, man, there's been tons and tons of money being dumped into this race. And so there's this one guy, his name in particular, and this is why I wanted to kind of focus on this race just quickly, is that this guy's name is Joel Ricketts, right? He is the founder and former CEO of TD Ameritrade, right? And he's basically got a net worth. It's about $2.1 billion. The net was in 2017, according to Forbes. So he has two political PACs. One is called the 45 Committee, right? And it's a 501c4. Again, when you have that, you don't need to disclose your donors. And then that spent $248,298 split evenly on advertisements either supporting Saccone or opposing Lamb, right? Including a $40,000 ad buy on online advertising paid out, right? A second group right? Also called, let me see what's the name of this one. I'm not going to be able to find it right away. The second group basically is also run by the same guy, has spent another several hundred thousand dollars in this race. So you've got one person, right, who's bankrolling these attack ads, right, by, you know, innocuous sounding organizations in that state. And for the first time, and this was kind of the other thing that was interesting to see how this works, we see that the Democratic Party, for the first time, has actually started to sink. Or I'm sorry, a Democratic Party associated PAC has just sunk some money behind Connor Lamb in that race. So the money that's pouring into this one particular race is pretty remarkable. But it shows us kind of the direction that we're headed. So that was interesting. And one I should say, the top majority PAC was called the Patriot Majority PAC. They just basically launched a $250,000 ad by attacking Rick Saccone. I'm sorry.
No, Ricketts is also one of the owners associated with the Chicago Cubs, and he was the one who shut down the Gothamist because of their workers decided to unionize.
Oh man, I hadn't made a connection. That's crazy. Yeah. Well, there you go. So you got the anti-union guy, the one who shot the. Oh, there we go. Right, which we talked about on this thing. Oh, crazy. Another interesting news: Madeline Dean, right?
Yes, Madeline Dean has jumped into the Pennsylvania fourth. The congressional fourth district primary, which is all of, there's like the wind is like knocking around my rattling my window. So I'm like,
the house is coming down, man.
So Madeline Dean is now running in the Montgomery County district, the Pennsylvania fourth. She is from Abington. She's having her campaign kickoff this weekend, with John Fetterman and Ed Rendell. She dropped out of the lieutenant governor's race and decided to run for the congressional race.
So wait, so Fetterman is going to be there with her?
Yes.
That's huge. That's great. I'm glad to see that. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
So Fetterman's going to be helping her out. That race. Also, Dale Leach dropped out this week.
People said mean things about
statement,
me.
Basically saying that he dropped out because of people he don't know who are attacking him. And still has not addressed the sexual harassment issues surrounding him. So he's now out of the race. I think like 15 Democrats are looking to run in the Pennsylvania 5th in the Delaware County district.
Once
Pat Meehan's seat. So that's now turning into a charade.
So wait, now the 5th, is the 5th also a part of the former 7th? Is that?
Yeah.
Thought so, right? So
pretty much all Delaware County.
Right.
And then out here, Jess King picked up the endorsement from the Lancaster County or Lancaster City Democratic Party. Because Christina Hartman, the DCCC back candidate from last time around, who was challenging Smucker in Lancaster and Reading, has decided to move to Harrisburg, the Pennsylvania 10th, because the Jess King's district has got a lot more redder. So she's moving just because this has some people upset out here because she's moving into a district where she has not spent any time campaigning in. She spent most of her time campaigning in Lancaster the past couple of years. And now she's up and moving to Harrisburg simply for self-preservation.
Right. So like demonstrating her commitment to Lancaster, she picks up her bags and moves away so that she has a chance of winning. It just becomes about her. That's
and,
nice.
The thing is, yes, she would probably be the favorite candidate out here. But, this district out here that I'm in now with Scott Perry, who goes from – this district went from like an R20 to an R6. So Scott Perry, who's a fucking wacko, would have to moderate himself a lot more. It would be a lot easier for a Democrat to win in theory if he's running as an ultra-conservative because the district's a lot more moderate now. This district has Hershey, which has a big medical center in there, Hershey Medical Center.
Yep.
It has the East Shore. It has all of pretty much Dauphin County. It has parts of the West Shore in Cumberland County, which has districts that went Democrat for the first time ever, had cities in you know, suburbs went Democrat for the first time ever in 2016. And it has the city of York. So there are three big Democratic centers out here. Dauphin County has a you know, 3,000 or 4,000 voter registration, Democratic voter registration edge, but they still can't seem to get their act together and win seats out here. So,
well, that's big. I mean, that's big. So I mean, that's going to be really interesting to see what happens in there. I mean,
so basically, if anything happens, the Democrats, they're going to lose a seat if they can't get their act together in Dauphin County, simply because of how inept the party is out here. The Dauphin County Democrats have a big voter registration edge over Republicans, but there's no party machine out here to get Democrats out to vote during off-year elections. And Dauphin County is stuck with a 2-1 Republican county commissioner seat, and they are stuck with three judges on district courts. And the funny thing is, usually there's always a deal in place with the judges, right? Mm-hmm. It's like pick three or choose one, right? You don't have to vote for all three. You can choose one to three judges. That you have Democrats that go in there, see one Democrat on the ballot, and then they vote for the other two Republican judges instead of voting for the one Democrat. And the deal that's always in place with the Republicans and the Democrat is the Democrat will always get family court, and the two Republicans will get the other district courts, the mm-hmm. other seats. Just because the Republicans don't want to deal with the family court stuff. So now there's three Republicans in Dauphin County, and you have someone who doesn't care about family court sitting on family court.
Mm, God.
Yeah. So this is how stupid the Democratic Party is out here.
Well, that's nuts. That's nuts. Well, you know, one reason to fight. Just more evidence of we need to do this. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day who's basically saying, man, you guys are pretty hard on the Democratic Party. I'm like, look. You got to understand, it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, when someone's doing
bad. You can't win if your own party is not inept.
Well, when somebody, you know, people are engaged in really bad behavior for a long period of time that's self-destructive, sometimes you got to hold an intervention. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not, you know, simply just, you know, just tearing down and stuff. But it's like looking at, look, let's put our efforts behind some really freaking awesome candidates that are out there. I mean, the fact that Fetterman is now, for example, the lieutenant governor, I mean, he's probably got to be up there close to the front runner at this point, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that just because of the party machine getting behind Stack in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting. You know, he's actually got a shot if people show up to vote. So we'll see about that. It will be tough getting past the Philadelphia bump, right? I mean, getting over that hill. Well, that's interesting. And the fact that you've got Madeline Dean now running, that's amazing because I think I think in that district, I think she's going to be a really, really strong candidate too.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Anyways, but, you know, speaking of if we flip it on the other side of things about not strong candidates and people that get us back into the world of holy crap, the nut jobs are running the show. Delaware County Republican Nick Micarelli, man. Holy.
Yeah. So he's been accused of drugging, raping and threatening women in prior relationships with a gun.
Let that sit for a set, everybody. Let that sit.
Yeah. He also sent a series of cryptic texts to the people writing the story, a couple of the journalists writing the story, saying pretty much that they're doing this at their own peril. And the day this story was published, there was actually extremely enforced security inside the Capitol. So there's two things here. Obviously, Nick Micarelli should step down. He's calls from his own party leaders for him to step down. There's calls from the governor for him to step down and resign. He was accused of raping people in prior relationships. There's just nothing you could say there besides that. That's pretty much it.
I do want to point out, though, because you got pretty pissed off about this on Twitter, about the way that some people were referring to this, right? And I think
sexual misconduct or sexual misbehavior.
Right. And this was not sexual misbehavior, what the allegations were.
No, this isn't forced sex. This is rape.
Right. Exactly.
And he is also believed to be one of the dozen or so representatives and senators that are packing heat in the Capitol.
But that's it for a second there, too, as well. I mean, the fact that...
So here you have male fragility.
Right.
People in a toxic environment carrying guns in the Capitol. And who's to stop someone like him or some of these other whack jobs that pop off a couple of rounds at someone in the Capitol?
No, exactly. So you got some of these people. That, I mean, look, you've got people like him packing heat in the... He's one of them, right?
He's supposed to. He is allegedly to be one of them.
Allegedly to be one of them. Okay. Let's put it this way. It would not surprise me if he was one of them. Right.
Yes.
I mean, given the fact that, you know, when he's talking about these accusations, these rape accusations, when these women have come forward and start talking about that, is that, you know, some of that is taking place, like, you know, threatens at gunpoint. Right. One woman
inside the story. One of the women who he is accused of these incidents with. She went as far as putting a note to her life insurance policy saying, if anything is to happen to me, he should be
investigated. That's incredible, man. That's chilling. It's chilling.
It just goes to show you how far this went. And the thing is, these are one of these stories that, you know, he's been working on for the past 4 months. And he's saying that, you know, this story came out within the past week because he got married a couple weeks ago and tried to ruin his marriage. When he used the hashtag not me in his statement, too.
Not me.
Yeah.
Isn't he clever? But, you know, that stuff really worries me because, you know, one of these points, especially when these kind of people get found out, you know, again, this is not for anybody who knows anything about, you know, sexual assault and the abusers and things like this is like, you know, very often these people are very good at putting up a public face of being, you know, jovial and kind of like likable and kind of, you know, engaging, whatever like this, while they're monsters when people aren't looking. And then when pressure gets applied, right, sometimes these monsters freak out. And they can't keep the public face up anymore. And that's the kind of stuff that worries me about that story about, you know, these folks packing heat in there. Because very often there's an overlap, right? I mean, again, let's go right back to what Colleen Clements has been talking about. Let's go right back to the whole idea about toxic masculinity. This is the perfect example of that, where you see the overlap between the love of guns and the kind of like the love of, like, you know, maintaining the patriarchy at all costs. And those things get kind of married in terms of like an identity. And it turns out that, you know, they're united simply by violence. And that's frightening.
And also going back to the gun issue, having senators and staffers walking around with guns in the Capitol, you know, like, you had a famous Bud Dwyer incident happen in the Capitol 20, 30 years ago when Bud Dwyer committed suicide by shooting himself at a press conference before he was found guilty of corruption charges. You know, you have that happened. And okay, so that happened. And there's still reporters up in the newsroom who were there that day. You know, there's still people in Harrisburg who were there that day working as reporters. You know, someone pulls a gun out. Like, your first thing you're doing is hitting the deck. You're hitting the floor. And it's like, who's to stop one of these people, like a Daryl Metcalf or some of these other people who just go unhinged at a press conference and start? It's a very serious thing. It's a workplace safety issue.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Hands down. There's no doubt about it. And if, like, in this environment right now, when so much attention is being paid to, like,
I mean, who's to stop a lobbyist from walking through? I mean, a lobbyist has a security badge.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, I have a security badge. We talked about this a few months ago. I have a security badge. Lobbyists have a security badge where you wave the badge, you go right through.
And you don't have to go through the metal detectors?
You don't have to go through the metal detectors. You can have something in your backpack. You can have something in your briefcase. You know, who's to stop us, a lobbyist or a legislator or someone who else has a security badge at doing this?
Exactly.
You know, it's not that safe of a place.
No. So frightening stuff, man. Frightening stuff. I don't know where to go from there. Just like, this is just bad. It's bad. I mean, all the more reason to keep it going. I feel like weird shifting gears at this point, but I do want to get to just a couple things before we go. One of the things that this goes right to the heart of the 2018 election and what where we started today's show on with the Janus decision. This past week was the budget hearings for the state system of higher education, PASHI, in the state Senate. Okay. And we talked about this a little bit last week. We had some really, really crappy audio on this, but so the good audio has come out now. Some of those hearings about Wagner. So let me set this up for you in terms of three players that should be seriously concerning to us. Well, two of them should be concerned. The other one is saying this is what we should be doing. So one of we obviously also three players that we should be concerned about. One that we should, you know, give the thumbs up. So at these hearings, you've got State Senator Scott Wagner, right, who is running for governor, basically coming out in his anti-union screed and basically saying, Pashi, you're not getting money anymore. These schools are going to close, right? One. Then you've got Senator Eichelberger comes out goes through his same. He basically asks these questions that makes the chancellor sound like she's kind of confirming what he's saying. And basically his things that he shops out every year is that faculty only work 12 hours a week, 17 hours a week, according to the contract. To give the chancellor credit, she said, or the interim chancellor credit, she's basically said probably faculty are working kind of a minimum of 45 hours a week. She said that. But he refused to hear that and said, no, he just wanted to repeat his points. So you got those two folks on these budget hearings. Then you've got the chancellor herself, the interim chancellor herself, coming out and basically talking about collective bargaining as being out of whack with the demands of the marketplace and all this kind of stuff. And she came back to at least twice, I believe three times in her stuff, where basically saying, you know, these union contracts are the problem. Right. The union contracts are the problem, not just faculty union contracts, but union contracts for state workers, like, you know, kind of grounds crew, for secretarial staff and so on. And all of those things that they're targeting, both Scott Wagner on the one side and the Chancellor of State System for Higher Education on the other, are exactly what is being targeted by the Janus case. And that's what's coming down the pike. Right? And the only thing that's preventing Pennsylvania right to work at this point is Governor Wolf. Otherwise, it would already be there. So. That being said, and then you've got on the other hand of things, you've got basically Senator Vincent Hughes basically coming up and saying, hey, look, this is not what we're going to do at all. Right. So I'm sorry, I got the phone ring. It's distracted me a little bit because I'm worried that my kids are going to be kind of forced to come home. So just give me a second on that. But so here's the deal. So basically what the deal is, what I want to do is I want to play just a little bit of sound from you from the hearing. And so what you're going to hear is you're going to hear Scott Wagner and then you're going to hear Vincent Hughes come in and you're going to hear a little bit of this exchange. And, you know, this is where Hughes is absolutely kind of so important. He's the only person. Right. The only state senator on that panel that said this. Right. There was nobody else that voiced something this strongly about the PASHI in the state system. So hear this and give a sense about the way that the Democratic Party or progressives, for that matter. If we need a third party, that's it. This is kind of the way the direction we should go in. So here it is. Wagner and Hughes exchange.
Your system is done in 4 years. You are out of runway. You are out of oxygen.
So I should start off. Yeah, this is Scott Wagner coming first. This is his claim, but he's talking to a student at this point, right? And he's basically saying, you're done, right? He's like, forget about your school, right? This is where he starts.
Your system is done in 4 years. You are out of runway. You are out of oxygen. And the taxpayers are not going to continue to pump money into the system. The union bosses have made sure that everybody has been highly taken care of, and they're driving you into bankruptcy. So for those of you that think your school's going to be around 4 years from now, it ain't going to be around. And I can tell you something, that we are going to stop pumping money into this system.
For all the students in the room, okay? For all the students in the room, go on social media. Tweet me right now. Pick up one of these. Tweet me right now. The system is not going anywhere in 4 years. Your education is set. Your education is solid. Your education is going to be there. Tell your students, tell your friends, let them know right now, text them right now. The universe, the state system of higher education, PASHI, is not going anywhere, okay? Because when people make irresponsible statements, okay, it's going to die, it's going to fall apart. It's not going to happen. That's irresponsible. that is completely irresponsible.
Now, I think that what you heard there, closing that out, that was State Senator Vincent Hughes. And, you know, he's got a history with the state system. I mean, he's been a strong advocate for a while. He told a story, which I don't have in the sound clip, told the story basically his father was part of the crew that basically originally put the state system together, starting in the late 70s up to when the state system was put together and founded in 1983. So his message there, the fact that he was the only one there that called out Wagner's garbage was so important. You know, because there's Democrats and there's Republicans on the session, but nobody else called Wagner out and called him to the, to the mat like Hughes did. So kudos to Hughes. And that is the kind of public discussion and public taking down or taking to task that has got to take place. And it drives me insane to see that you've got, you know, for the most part, Democrats on that panel just kind of let it go by. As if everyone just gets to say what they want to say, and that's it. Hughes was the only one that actually engaged something. So that was kind of really important in those hearings. The other thing I just want to say, so this is kind of the concerning part there too as well. Not only do you have Wagner and do you have Eichelberger that are coming after collective bargaining and kind of going after this, the faculty contract ends, right, in this June, okay? Faculty contract ends because it was a one-year extension from the previous contract. All right, that ends, and guess what happens? Janus kicks in. Janus, right? So we get Janus kicks in, and then negotiations are going to be happening for in that environment, right? So things are coming together now, and then what's the attitude? The big question: what's the attitude from the Chancellor's office? Now you recall. We talked about Howard Bunces. Howard Bunces came and appeared at the at Kutztown University. We kind of hired him to come in and kind of do an independent report on this. And one of the things that he said, one, obviously the administration is lying about this, which we know, about what their budget crisis and all that stuff. But the one thing that he said is he had never seen like such anti-union language coming from a chancellor's office. He said usually that they'll say these things behind the scenes, but they'll never say them in public, right? Because they don't want to be taken to task. He said, instead, you've got it in a bond report. You've got anti-union language in a bond report. And he said the only place that comes from is it comes from the administration. And so that took him back. And I asked him, you know, when I interviewed him and I wrote this in the article that I wrote in Raging Chicken, I said, you know, well, okay, is this unusual or is this, you know, so he's like, no, this is completely unique. You never see this kind of stuff. Right. And the fact that you see the anti-unionism come to the surface. Right. And hear them calling for kind of ends the collective bargaining. We said that we had this at, you know, with Frank Brogan before. But the interim chancellor, Karen Whitney, who was the former university president at Clarion, who oversaw the gutting of that faculty there. This is kind of like her perspective on collective bargaining that she brought before the committee. This is Karen Whitney.
There are larger issues here that the workforce needs, that's needed in teaching and learning at these universities, and probably the 60 or 70-year-old construct of collective bargaining are out of whack.
Right, and there she is, right? There she is coming right out and kind of going right after collective bargaining. And like I said, she does that a couple more times in the hearings. So my message there too as well is like, look, the kind of fights that we have to gear up for right now are the kind of fights that we have to prepare to organize and push back. No one is going to save us. We can only save ourselves. Right. And this is why, you know, I look at the, you know, I hate beating a dead horse on this one. But when ABSCUF went on strike, right, faculty of the state system of higher education went on strike in 2016 and stood there kind of shoulder to shoulder with students organizing on our campuses. And basically we said, look, this is the vision of what we need. This is our campus. We together, faculty and students together, are the only way that we can defend higher education. This is why I'm so encouraged by to see what's happening with the PA Student Power Network across the state. Like I mentioned at the beginning of this show today, they were out at like 12 locations across the state, like spread out across the state, defending DACA, DACA, demanding kind of protection for Dreamers, demanding the passage of a Clean Dream Act, right? And they continued to build, right? Out in Reading Area Community College, RAC, right, established its first chapter of the PA Student Power Network there. And they're doing the concrete organizing the ground among students and building that network. The same has to happen among faculty. And like I said, we talked about when we were we looked at West Virginia, when we're talking about Janus, the only thing that we can do moving forward now is to build our connections with our communities, right? Something that, frankly, labor unions have neglected for a long time. We need to get back to that idea that we are embedded in our communities and that we're standing with them, right? Not just asking for their support when we need it, but investing back in our communities and building power from the ground up. Social movement unionism, folks. That's the only solution we can have in this post-Janus world. So that was just a particular example. So I don't know, man. It's like I wish I could have been there for those hearings, to be honest with you, because it's just I listened to them. I listened to the recordings of, or, you know, I watched them on YouTube and stuff. And I was like, man, I'm just shaking my head during that. Not so much at, you know, what you expect coming out from Scott Wagner and Eichelberger and these people, but the lack of like taking these people to task was just blew my mind. So I don't know. So a couple quick things before we go, because there's all the money in the world and we don't need teachers. The School Reform Commission down in Philadelphia voted to spend $20 million on cyber classes because that makes sense. Not. Right. This shows you, once again, anti-teacher bias that's going out there. And my favorite for the day has to be the fact that, students from a Northeast Pennsylvania school district for Wallam-Powpack Area School District, they actually were relocated on this past Wednesday because the little cult leader up there has got his, he's got his little church. He's got a special little church called the World Peace and Unification Sanctuary Church, right? You know, in other words, the cult leader, Hyung Jin Moon, I think is how you say this. They had a commitment ceremony, which they encouraged their whatever you call them, their members or their brainwashed people, whatever you want to have, to bring their AR-15s for a commitment ceremony so they can bless their AR-15s. And some of those participants, like I said, even had crowns of bullets on them. And I mean, Sean, you saw these pictures, right?
Yeah, they were fucking crazy.
I mean, that's just something I see. Like, I'm like, is this actually happening here? Yes. And sure enough, it was nuts. But you think about it. That's how scared the folks were in that school district, right? They actually pulled their kids out of school. They sent them to alternative locations to make sure that they were nowhere near the gun nuts that are there. And I was reading a little bit into that. And, you know, they've got this whole bizarre ideology where they've actively married. And I guess the guy who runs this, the Moon who runs it now, is the son of the founder or something like this. And there's something in the Bible that says for commitment ceremonies, you have like rods of lead or something like this. And so they built this into their ideology that the rods of lead are symbolized by the AR-15s. And so they're marrying guns with Christianity in this cult abomination that's happening in Northeast PA. So there you go, folks. Welcome from craziness in Pennsylvania. Anyways, we're going to take our last break of the day. Just got the notice that, yes, indeed, my kids are going to have early dismissal today, which, of course, is going to throw my Friday into whack once again. But, you know, here we go. That's the way it is. And we're going to come back with a quick last call today. So Sean can maybe take another little nap before he's got to go to work. Make sure he's all up to par. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Remember, become a member. Patreon.com/RC Press. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. It's the last call. Yeah, we're going to kind of a quick last call today, in part because blizzard conditions outside, early kids dismissal, and Sean just wants to get the heck out of here today. He's sick and tired of hearing me talk. But, you know, that's nothing new. So here we go. I just got to kind of just give the kudos, and I'm going to put these links in our show notes today. But I'm going total political fanboy here. Sarah Kendzior, she's a journalist, and just, I mean, I've always been a fan of her. She's absolutely fantastic. Some of the most critical writing that's out there. She's, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, I hear her talk. She's on the Rick Smith show quite frequently. And every time she comes on, I'm like, man, this is the kind of voice that we need in journalism. But this week, man, she was on top of her game and she was on fire. She was on Rick's show on Thursday. And again, I'm going to put a link to the show in today's show notes. And basically talking about watching, you know, the Mueller revelations this week, because the Russia stuff has been nuts this week. We didn't even talk about it. And frankly, whatever, it's like these people are just spinning out of control. But she's just kind of just basically got so mad, right? She's like, I may sound pissed because I'm pissed. And basically saying, like, look, the kind of things that we're seeing in here, and her level of frustration was so high because the kind of things we're seeing in the Trump administration right now were completely predictable. And frankly, she was writing about this stuff, and she wasn't completely alone in this, but there were journalists that were writing about what the Trump administration was doing, what was happening, not just with Russia, but all the kind of corruption, all of the kind of like mafioso type practices from the Trump administration, that when they wrote these things and they were on TV shows and stuff talking about them, they were kind of dismissed and poo-pooed out of hand as being kind of like conspiracy theorists and crazy and you're just making stuff up. And yet every single thing that they were saying is proven to be true, right? And she was so frustrated because they say, like, look, if people had just been on the ball back in 2016 or as early as 2015, right, or as early as 2002, right, we never would have been in the place we're in right now. So, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, obviously you should check out the Rick Smith show all the time anyways, right? But check out Sarah Kendzior's interview on Thursday, which is fantastic. And the other one, it's been a while since I checked out her stuff, and Francesca Fiorentini, she basically has a weekly kind of video podcast type of thing with AJ Plus, and it's called News Broke. And she's kind of a comedian, a journalist, you know, and she's fantastic. I think she's funny. I think she's, you know, she's smart as all heck and does so much. So she's had a piece this week. And I've been circulating on my own accounts on Facebook. It's called Why the Rich Love Destroying Unions. Definitely check it out. It's really important. It's a great way to circulate it to your friends. It's funny in part, but she runs through the implications in the background around Janus, right, in a completely non kind of, you know, in the weeds way, right, in a way that you kind of you get access to kind of what the implications are in a very accessible way. It's the kind of thing you need to share out with your friends, and she'll have that there. And there's this one scene in there. I tell you, I was telling Sean beforehand, I was like literally on the floor laughing. there's a scene, there's some activists that are kind of surrounding Nancy Pelosi at one point, right? And they're kind of chanting, right? They're chanting at her, and she starts, you know, she thinks it's all like good that they're all there in support of her, and then she's kind of like realizes that, oh no, they're angry at her. Right. And so she starts going, go away. Go away now. No, stop it. Just stop it. She starts chanting back at them. Just stop it. Just stop it. And then she's like, I'm a Democrat. I'm a Democrat. Right. And it was just like, I mean, it was like, oh my God. Like, she just like cannot even, she just, there's no place to put this in her world. And Fiorentina comes back and she's like, she does this little skit. And then she's basically saying, Nancy Pelosi comes back. She's like, oh my God. Oh my God. Help me. Wait, go away, kids. Go. Shoo. 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 Why won't they go away? Why don't they like me? And I just got to play this one little clip. And she ends this part talking about Nancy Pelosi's response to these activists. And this is what threw me over. She's like, go away. Go away, kids. Go. Go away. Go away. And then.
Go play with your spidget finner.
I just love that.
Go play with your spidget finner.
And that was kind of exactly it. So check that out. And but more importantly, you know, I would like her page and all that kind of stuff. But more importantly, circulate that around. It's a really important way to get out the information about Janice to people that really don't even know what's going on with that stuff. That's important. Last thing I'll say, a couple things quick. Free Will, they've come out again. They released again their love letter from the 90s. It was out before. And Sean, you had that, right?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I remember you saying that was a really good one. It's like, I love that one.
Oh, yeah, I had it. I just,
the can. Yeah, the can of it. Yeah, super, super good. And want to remind everybody that tomorrow, March 3rd, is Saucony Creek's 5th anniversary birthday party. And they're going to be at the brewery out in Kutztown. That's going to be going on from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. They have a little celebration. They're going to release the Unicorn. That's a kind of Northeast IPA that they come out periodically with, and it's really super good. And there's going to be some bands out there, Hannah Violet from 12 to 3 and Frog Holler from 3 to 6. If you get a chance, kind of head out there and you know, let them know that Raging Chicken has been talking about them, right? Let them know that you're listening to this podcast, you're going to check them out, Raging Chicken Press, give us a shout out with them. We try to give them a shout out all the time because, look, I like investing in kind of, you know, local stuff. So, anyways, anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
Did you see what the PLCB did this week?
No.
They released $705,000 in grants to promote the growing beer industry in Pennsylvania.
Oh, did they now?
Yes. So some of them is a couple things like 12 geographic like trail tours for like different breweries and bars in different areas of the state. A couple of them like for making a documentary on the beer in Pennsylvania, like the brewing process, ways to find out how to dry hops easier. Yeah, some different things that happened this week.
Wow. How about that? That's going to be pretty.
And the brewing industry in Pennsylvania is a $5.8 billion business. It's a $5.8 billion industry, second to California.
Second to California, right here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
See? Something to be proud of, everybody. Something to be proud of. That's going to be cool. I'm glad they're going to do that stuff. I mean, because, you know, I know that when you go out to California, I went out to Portland, you can pick up guides all over the place about, you know, how to go through and do your kind of craft brew tours in different areas. That's going to be really cool. And I hope it, you know, keeps developing. All right, man. Well, I guess batten down your hatches and the windows and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to go out and try to figure out when I got to go pick up my kids because we just got the notice that they've got early dismissal. And, you know, we'll keep up the fight, everybody. I hope that you stay safe this weekend if you're out in the Northeast where the storm is kind of coming through. Anything else, Sean?
No, that's it.
All right, that's it. Happy weekend, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back next week without the coop. Well, Sean will be in D.C. taking over Hope Hicks's position. Talk to you later, everybody. See ya!
One of the reasons why we have problems in higher education in Pennsylvania is because the state ranks 47th out of 50th of all states in the nation in what it contributes to all of higher education. You want a message to send back? Is make the state put more money into higher education. And in fact, let's talk about trying to figure out a way to make college free for all students in Pennsylvania.